Hi, my name is Johnny Gartner, and thank you so much for joining us for this week's episode of the Cedar 60 podcast. At Cedar 60, our mission is to engage with culture and politics from the distinctive lens of the gospel. Today, we're excited to have Dr. Matthew Bennett on the podcast to discuss the mission field of culture. Dr. Bennett, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate having you on.
Absolutely. Thank you, Jonathan.
If you could first, like we have all guests, just kind of introduce yourself to the listeners, talk a little bit about your background, and then maybe what brought you into the Cedarville community.
Sure. Yeah. My name is Matt Bennett, and I've been teaching at Cedarville for about 6 years now. My wife and I moved back from the mission field. We had been living in North Africa and the Middle East for about 7 years, and came back to take this job where I get to teach missions and theology at Cedarville University. And it's just been a real joy to be involved on this end of hopefully shaping and casting vision for the next generation of missionaries who will go all over the world, bringing the beautiful message of the gospel to the ends of the earth.
Maybe what sparked the transition from missions to being a professor, and maybe how do you see those things being connected?
Yeah. So honestly, in some ways, it was a little bit of kicking and screaming that the Lord just was in the process of aligning a number of different things on the field that showed us there were some transitions coming. We didn't really know what to expect, assumed that it meant transitions on the field, but there were some team dynamics with people taking different roles and things of that nature that caused us to be aware that we were going to need to make some changes to what we were doing. And in the process, door after door ended up closing that we tried to push on. And sort of out of left field, the Lord brought an opportunity to apply for this role that brings together two things that I was becoming ever more convinced needed to be together, that being the discipline of theology and missions. And this was the door that he opened. And so kind of in our expectation of things, I had been pursuing my doctoral work with a desire to be in the classroom at some point, but assumed that that would be kind of a second career type thing as opposed to something with this timing. But the Lord knows what he's doing. And our prayer is that our role in the classroom at a place like Cedarville can be used to hopefully multiply ourselves and the things that the Lord has shaped us with and taught us on our time in our time on the mission field. I hope that we can pass those things along and be of use to students who are thinking along the same lines.
So one of the projects that you've been working on since coming to Cedarville, I should say, is a new book which is titled Hope for American Evangelicals, and in it you talk a lot about kind of the work you were doing while you were a missionary, and a little bit about the work you're doing now. I'm sure you had a lot of experiences with the church in America, the church overseas, the Big C Church, the Little C Church. So if you could maybe talk about, the title is very interesting. It's Hope for American Evangelicals. So if you could talk maybe about what you see as being kind of the current state of evangelicalism, maybe Big E evangelicalism in America, and why there's a reason or a need for this book to be written.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't think it's any secret or surprise that evangelical is a word that's increasingly being questioned as to whether or not it's helpful because of some of the really hurtful things that have been associated with it. Some things that have been truly ugly, and we need to confront them and say, man, within our house, there have been things that have been disordered. And I think we do well when confronted with some of those broader issues, whether it be very public figures who have been in ministry and who have been exposed to be involved in ugly patterns of sin, or whether it's an overarching culture of celebrity that's infused into some of our ministry patterns, or any number of things. We need to be honest about those issues, but I fear that sometimes in our honesty with those issues that really need to be addressed, we've also gone a little bit too far and started questioning like whether or not the foundations of what we've been building on and why we've been using that word evangelical for a long time. I fear that we are on the cusp of throwing out some of the baby with the bathwater. And so Hope for American Evangelicals is an attempt to be able to say, man, there's much to be preserved and restored here. And I just want to make sure that we don't get so caught up in recognizing things to be critiqued that we lose a grip on our moorings.
That's really good. I don't want this episode to be a replacement for reading the book, because I highly recommend reading the book. We don't have time to get into all the points that the book makes. But one of the main motifs in your book, and kind of the cover on the title page, is a house. And you write kind of framing kind of different sections of the book based on the process of you getting ready to sell your childhood home. Kind of talk a little bit about how that kind of helped you shape your writing for this book and how it could help us as the reader or the listener think about how we can order our lives too.
Yeah. So up till this point, I've written a handful of books that are a little bit more academic in nature. And in that sense, you can write in such a way, assuming that hopefully if it's useful, a professor is assigning it somewhere and people have to read it. This was the first book that I wrote kind of more on a popular level. And I realized if people don't have to read it, there's got to be something to incentivize them to keep going. And so I tried to use an extended analogy of coming back to a place that was familiar to you with fresh eyes that occur from being gone for a while. And so I gave this extended analogy of what it was like for me to come back to my childhood home, having been gone for 6 or 7 years, and to look at it in the process of helping my mom prepare it to be sold, and realizing that those spaces that were still familiar and still carried all the nostalgia of all the memories that I had growing up there, the appreciation that I have for it being a place of formation and truly my home, that had at times obscured my vision of some of the things that probably needed some attention. So coming back with a fresh set of eyes, trying to look at the familiar space with the eyes of somebody who might be considering purchasing it, gave me a fresh sense of identifying those things that were in need of attention. And so I use that then of saying, in a similar way, coming back to these familiar evangelical spaces that we love and that are and have been so formative in our lives, with the eyes of a missionary, having been in places that are very different and fellowshipped with brothers and sisters who have not grown up in a country and a context where they could assume that the government or the broader community supported them and was interested in their free practice of their faith, gave us some fresh lenses to be able to say, what would some of these issues look like if we looked at them not with eyes of familiarity and comfort back home, but with a desire to see them as a missionary would.
I really like that. In the book, you use a word, contextualization, which I think is really interesting, talking about how as a missionary, when you go to a different culture, kind of like you just referenced, you have to contextualize yourself to the different ways that that culture operates. I think a lot of times in America, we kind of subliminally reference this, talking about how, you know, like the culture war and Christians are supposed to be in the world, but not of the world. But we don't really necessarily take that idea. We need to understand the culture so that we can minister as the Bible calls us to. So what ways would you suggest, maybe based on the book or your own experience, that American evangelicals who should be reading your book can kind of contextualize themselves to the 21st century American culture we find ourselves in?
Yeah, well, I think for missionaries, especially in the process of preparing to go overseas, we talk about contextualization as something that we do to change or reshape some of our articulation of the unchanging truths of the gospel or the way that we function as a church. And sometimes we imbibe the implicit understanding that we're taking something pure and we are changing it to be appropriate in another place. And we don't actually take the time to realize that what we are expressing is already a contextualized form in our spaces. So I think in some ways, just alerting us to the fact that we're always taking the unchanging truths of Scripture and making them manifest and applied in a given context, and then assessing our expressions off of the biblical truth to say, is this still faithful? Is this appropriate as an extension of biblical truth in this time and place? And so I think just even calling our attention to the fact that our Christianity is contextualized to some assumptions and cultural forms and things that are natural and native here gives us pause to be able to say, maybe if our broader culture is changing and perhaps at an accelerated rate around us, maybe the same task that a missionary going to a foreign context needs to do to assess the forms that we're employing, the way we're talking about things, does that actually communicate what we intend to communicate? Even if it is challenging, it should still be challenging as the gospel, but how does this land? How do my hearers hear it? Well, in a foreign context, you have to do the long work of understanding somebody's worldview and asking lengthy questions and listening well to understand, hey, when I say we are sinners, what does that convey to you? And what then do I need to do to make sure that the biblical understanding of sin is clarified so that then the biblical understanding of salvation is also clarified? Well, if our culture is not necessarily any longer in the same place that it was 10, 20 years ago, then we should be expecting, rather than bemoaning the changes, we should be expecting that if we're going to communicate this unchanging message faithfully in a changed context, that we're going to need to do some of that investigative work to be able to understand what are those underpinning assumptions that our neighbors, who were our neighbors 10 years ago, but have perhaps shifted along with the culture, how are they answering some of those profound questions that everybody has to wrestle with about what's the purpose of life? What's right in the world and what's wrong? Where does sin or where does suffering come from? And then what might be the solution? How do we know what we know? Those are things that have shifted and we need to be attuned to it if we're going to be meaningfully engaging with those neighbors. So that's what I'm pushing us towards.
Yeah, I think that's really great. I think one of the things we're seeing now is that people are becoming really invested in the engagement and losing focus on the actual gospel, like you kind of referenced there. I think in chapter 5, this I don't think was the intention of the chapter, but you're talking about sexual immorality as a, you know, one of the bedrock issues that Christians are struggling with. And you talk about how we can often focus on, you know, the issue of purity and modesty as the solution to sexual immorality. And it's a great thing to focus on. I want to be clear about that. But it can often distract from what Paul writes about in 1 Corinthians 15, you know, those things of first importance, the gospel. And so how, in your research for the book and your experiences overseas and now as a professor here at Cedarville, have you seen that take hold kind of in the evangelical community? And what ways do you think we can avoid that in the future? Maybe kind of a similar question to what we just talked about, though.
Yeah. Well, I would say that for that, in some ways, I'm really indebted to Rachel Welcher and her book, Talking Back to Purity Culture. I'd highly recommend, you know, obviously, I want you to read my book, but I'd highly recommend going to her material because she does such a great job of affirming the central importance of saying a biblical sexual ethic of every conservative articulation of it that you want to put forward is absolutely necessary for the church to uphold. But we don't uphold that as the standard for the gospel. Like we can't make that the gospel or elevate it in a way that is obscuring the true reality of the fact that we live in a culture that has dedicated what I think we can rightly call worship to the pursuit of sexual gratification. That is idolatry. And in some ways, what she, I think, was attuned to and what I was trying to push us to see kind of as a missionary goes abroad and looks for signs of idolatry to confront with the gospel amidst a new people. I think coming back with those same types of lenses, you can't help but see that even in the church, sometimes we have kept a hedge of appropriate biblical structure around our sexual ethic, but we've smuggled in the same promises that the world is holding out to us about sex, that it will fulfill us. So instead of indulging in unbridled sexual pursuits like the world does, we say, no, that's behind the threshold of marriage, but we don't go so far as to cut off the root promise that sexual fulfillment is true fulfillment. And so in some ways we've perpetuated the idolatry while baptizing it with biblical ethic. And so I just wanted to push us to say, let's make sure if we are trying to rightly direct our worship to the only one to whom it is due, and to encourage our people to seek ultimate fulfillment in what will ultimately fulfill, let's not stop short and believe some of those poisonous lies from the culture that sex is really where it's at. It's a good gift from the Lord within the context of a biblical marriage. And it certainly is not something to be totally dismissed in terms of its importance to our humanity, our relationships, our marriage, and things like that. It's a good gift, but it is not God. And I just want to point out some of those things that, you know, as a missionary, some of your idolatry antenna start beeping when you start seeing some of those glimpses, and sometimes it takes place still in the sanctuary even.
I had the opportunity to take you for Theology 1 class at Cedarville, and in the class you say that sin is misdirected worship, and I really loved that analogy for how sin replaces the ultimate worship and misdirects it towards these other idols, just like you were saying. And I think that's a really good way to frame kind of the conversation in the book. One of the people you reference a lot in the book, kind of who undergirds a lot of the writing, who you cite as a person who kind of lives this kind of mission you're calling us to, is, I might mispronounce his name, but I think it's Leslie Newbegin. And if you could talk a little bit about how he kind of came into your research and kind of what inspired you to write about him and kind of how he influenced the writing of this book.
Yeah. So honestly, in some ways, he is really, really helpful to this book because he's somebody who's gone before me and who really, in many ways, was kind of a companion, even in our own return, because he's a missionary. He's a English missionary from the mid 20th century, served in India for about 40 years. And then in the 1970s or so, he came back to England. And a lot of his writing career was actually this second career as a pastor and professor in England, in a place that he grew up in, but now had come back with retrained reflexes as a missionary who had been ministering in India. And so in many ways, he helped to pave the way for me returning, and just was giving articulation to some of the things that I maybe didn't have words for in our first weeks back. And honestly, even as I'm writing about some of these things that I'm perceiving externally, it was really helpful to have him being the one to give voice to that, because the fact of the matter is I'm not coming back as somebody who has it all together as a missionary. I'm actually coming back as somebody who's being confronted by the very same tendencies that, as I've come back into a familiar place, it's real easy for me to just kind of slide back into the patterns and behaviors and perspectives that I knew beforehand. And so his voice has been a challenge to me. And this book is actually, I pray that it doesn't come across as some missionary who comes back on a high horse thinking that he's got it all figured out for Americans, but rather that this was kind of a cathartic and even convicting process for myself as I realized, man, there's still bits of idolatry, there's still misconceptions, there's a lure of self-aggrandizement. There's all these things that still reside in my heart. And so I hope that as the readers read along, they're sensitive to the fact that any critique I'm levying is one that first has landed on myself and that is I'm still working through in process. So Newbegin's voice then serves as an outsider to kind of convict all of us.
I really like in the book, you make a distinction between the church in America versus the American church and how kind of placing that adjective in front of the church kind of distorts its mission. I think in the church in America, we can often think of mission field being outside of America and that we need to send our resources and our time there. And we often neglect our neighborhoods or the neighbors we live next to or the people we work with. And you talk about in chapter six, this humble self-forgetfulness of Newbegin and how that affected his ministry. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about how we can take the example of Newbegin, kind of like you have, and apply that to our own mission field of a sense. Although in the book, you kind of distinguish between, kind of being missional versus being a missionary. So if you could just talk about that in general.
Well, I think, it's probably a little bit passe to crack on social media or the internet era or whatever, but passe or not, there is some accuracy in this that does bring us to a place where we need to consider how much the potential to be public figures has influenced the way that we go about ministry in general. I think a simple example of a pastor today is preaching a message that for the vast majority of churches is not merely being received by the people in the congregation there that day, but is being piped onto Facebook Live or YouTube, or sound bites might go on Twitter or something like that. And so there's a second audience that is present and perhaps receiving and perhaps praising that message. And so the temptation then to consider, how efficiently can I minister if I start multiplying the extent of my reach and my platform? Well, the temptation is the bigger the platform I build for myself and my ministry, the more ability I will have to serve King Jesus. And so it may look like I'm building my own brand, but really the ultimate goal is to build my brand to have a broader reach for the Lord. And one of the books that I read right after coming home, I think it was just really providential, was this book called The Way of the Dragon and the Way of the Lamb by Jamin Goggin and Kyle Strobel. And I'd highly recommend that book, but it just really looks at the ways that we have that temptation and that tendency to try to build a bigger kingdom for ourselves with the veneer of desire to build for the Lord's kingdom. But the reason I go down that road for answering this question is that I think sometimes we think of efficiencies as how many people can we affect with this big platform ministry, such that we actually get distracted from the neighbors, the individual people who are placed in our lives sovereignly, that we have opportunity to have a meaningful interpersonal, not depersonalized and cyber type relationship with, but embodied across the fence, in the backyard, in the neighborhood, at a barbecue. And I think that just recapturing the fact that ministry is life on life, and even if it seems desirable to have a bunch of people who are quoting you and retweeting you and citing you as their favorite pastor or minister or something like that, that desire is oftentimes actually distracting from meaningfully being invested in people's lives. So I don't know if that gets at exactly the question you were asking, but trying to think of ministry again as something that is inextricably relational.
I think as someone studying political science or as someone who's trying to learn how to kind of engage in culture faithfully, it's really easy to get lost in the mindset that, you know, we need this one person to go in and save the country, or, you know, as a voter to look for that one person who can go in and save the country. And in the book you write, the remedy is not to deny the necessity for leadership, but it is the summons to leadership which models of the one whose words follow me are constitutive of the church. And you also write that engaging in the public square boldly as a Christian is necessary, but we have to have confidence squarely grounded in the kingdom of heaven, where our citizenship is unshakably rested. And that, honestly, in our context of today, almost seems subversive in some ways, mm-hmm. and probably for good reason, because it is. And so if you could talk a little bit about how people looking to take jobs in these very culturally murky contexts of government or business, or wondering how they should apply the conversation of this book to how they vote, not necessarily for particular candidates, but, you know, just the general principles that you're hoping to get across. In the chapter, you talk about politics, but also just in context of the whole books as well.
Yeah. I think if you boil it down, probably what would be most helpful to think through is, what are my ultimate hopes founded in? Like, am I giving myself to a particular pursuit because I'm laying upon it an inappropriate hope that if this is successful, then Christ's kingdom will be successful? Or am I actually believing the things that Jesus said, that not even the gates of hell will stand against the church? And so I think that locus of where we place our hope, our most ultimate hopes, is vitally important for being an organizing structure for the rest. You think of even just the thoughts that might occur in your head, or the things that you hear from other believers, perhaps at times on an election year. Statements like, if candidate X wins, then the church is going to close its doors. That belies in my mind a sense of inappropriate or misappropriated hopes, saying, man, our hope is not in the legislation of something that will protect our freedoms. Praise the Lord for the freedoms that we enjoy, and we should, for the common good, be supportive of these things. We should be seeking to influence the broader society with biblical principles, believing that, in fact, they are for the common good. But we also recognize that no law or legislation is going to bring people to the gospel. And it's also something that is not going to be the ultimate salvation of our nation or our world. That's going to be driven by some sort of a political entity, but rather our hope is already securely founded in the King and his kingdom, the one who has all authority in heaven and on earth. And so there's a security in that that allows us to influence the society around us and to say, man, God has spoken, and this is for your good, to be ordering your life according to these patterns. But before you can order your life according to these patterns, your heart needs to be reordered. So we as the church are going to serve as a subversively contrast community, where we're saying we're going to live out these principles of the kingdom, not because we think that we have the capacity to live according to the law, because that's been demonstrably refuted in every one of our lives, as well as biblical history and world history. But rather, as a gospel-transformed people under the reign of King Jesus, we want to do our best to live by the power of the Spirit and his sanctifying work as a community that is seeking to, in contrast to the broader world, live out a different set of hopes, a different set of orientations to the world, and one that we hope will be reinforcing of the gospel we proclaim. Because the gospel, not the legislation, is going to be the thing that is going to transform and remain into the eschaton.
I love that. I have a professor at Cedarville who says he's a I'm forgetting the quote here, but he's a theocratic monarchist and he's a representative of the coming administration. And I think that's kind of a hilarious way to kind of spark a rethinking in your brain of what it means to be a Christian in the 21st century. I think, man, I love that even if it's not politics, if it's business or if it's being a nurse, those things are, a calling to love our neighbor like the Bible calls us to. And in loving our neighbor, reflect them to the gospel. I think really it's easy to think, if we just pass this bill, we're going to save America or something like that. And wanting to save a country that you think is going down the wayward path is an honorable vision. But I think the ultimate message is that whether or not America wins in the temporary sense is irrelevant in light of the fact that Christ has already won. And so that's a really great way to think of it. I think Dr. White kind of helps frame us for college students as that when he refers to our pursuit of a degree as vocational ministry. And if so, you could talk a little bit about how, thinking about Cedarville, your time as a student, even if you're well past graduated and listening to this, you can think of your time of training or whatever time of life you're in as an opportunity to be equipped to then go out into the world and use those gifts and passions for the kingdom. So if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, any of the occupations that you've trained for here at Cedarville are things that are good aspects of being people who bear God's image in God's world and function together as societies to enable growth, enable culture, enable agriculture and education. I mean, all of these things, healthcare, they're good aspects to be training in. But again, in a similar way to the where are our ultimate hopes, I think we could ask the question, what is our ultimate definition of the good? Mm-hmm. Is it to be an excellent educator? Is it to be an excellent surgeon? Is it to be an excellent athlete? I mean, all of those things are good, but they're not ends in and of themselves. They're means to making much of King Jesus. Mm-hmm. And so that's where, I mean, any of those things that you've trained for, do it with excellence and give it your all, because you are a person by your vocation who is serving the Lord in all that you do and offering him worship by means of pursuing excellence and diligence, investing yourself, stewarding your opportunities. Those are all ways to reflect God and to worship him, but they're also not self-interpreting. And so to enter into a contested arena like the healthcare discipline, and to be having to adjudicate between, what is asked of you as a physician versus what a biblical set of principles is, you can be an excellent physician and then compromise on some of your biblical morals, and in so doing, undermine some of the testimony that you're intending to be preparing yourself to give. And so excellence for excellence sake is not what you're after. Excellence, according to integrity, as instructed by the Bible and as reinforced by your convictions, is something that should provide for you a platform to proclaim the gospel. Because again, this is something we run into on the mission field. There's a lot of people who will go overseas as physicians or as educators and be drawn to places where they can use their discipline to benefit people who are under-resourced in those areas. And man, those are great things. But unless there's proclamation of the gospel, it's not missions. It's just good intended behavior. Because caring for the poor is not proclaiming the gospel. It can be a great platform for answering the question, why have you given up so much to care for these people who you didn't know? Well, I'm compelled to do so because I'm one who's been forgiven much. Can I tell you the gospel message that is my motivation? At the proclamation point, now you have this foil of your excellence, this foil of your ethically framed approach to your vocation that reinforces the message. But the reinforcement is not the message itself. And so I'd just encourage you to pursue excellence, pursue diligence, be a person of integrity and conviction in everything that you do, but do that with the prayer, Lord, today would you give me opportunity to speak and to translate for the people around me why I am distinctive in my approach to our vocation and how the gospel has that impact, because the proclaimed word is really the heart of our gospel work.
In the conclusion, which I don't want to give away because it's really great, you say that the church is the signpost for a kingdom that is ultimate amidst a world of rival kingdoms. And I think that oftentimes we think of being Christians in America that, you know, there's not a whole lot of cost to it. And I'm sure you've seen firsthand the cost of following Christ abroad. So as we wrap up the conversation, if you could kind of give an exhortation to people listening and encouragement on why they should read the book and how it brings into focus that there is a cost, but that that cost is worth it in light of the things we've talked about today.
Well, I think probably the best way I can do that is by bragging on some of our Egyptian brothers and sisters who have labored long in faithfulness in a place where they've never been able to enjoy government protections or freedom of exercise of their faith, and have always had much cost to pay in order to be faithful. And one of the things that I take away from our 7 years in the Middle East was a conversation with one of my friends where it was in the middle of a revolution. There had been a couple of different revolutions, governments toppled, chaos in the streets, people literally shooting each other, rival groups every Friday, just absolute chaos. And I got a phone call in the middle of one of the biggest holidays of the Islamic world from one of my friends. He said, "Hey, come find us. Come find us out at this place. I want you to see something." And so I went out. Again, it was pretty chaotic. There were different groups of people, factions of people who were protesting, things like that. So snuck out there, a little trepidation in my heart, and I found a group of about 20 believers. And they had this huge banner, and under the banner on it said, "We are Christians who are called to love our Muslim neighbors, and as you celebrate your holiday, we want to pray for you in Jesus' name." And then underneath this banner that they were publicly walking down this huge road openly with, they were handing out Bibles and New Testaments and tracts and Jesus films. And I looked at my friend, and I said, "Joseph, you can't do this. Like, you're going to get thrown in jail." And he looked at me like I was crazy. And he was like, what do you mean we can't do this?" He said, "It's a new day in Egypt. There's chaos and a new government. We don't know what we can't do. So we figured, why not try something that's going to be gospel courageous?" And I just, the default for our brothers and sisters in some of those places is not to clamor after their rights, but to get as close to the line of what's going to perhaps get them in trouble in order to be bold for the gospel. And so in whatever comes down the pike for us in American evangelicalism, I pray that that's our disposition, that before we spend all of our energies clamoring for the maintenance of our rights or some of these cultural privileges we have enjoyed in the past, that instead we'd say, let's be bold with what we need to be bold about. Let's be winsome as we can, but let's hold out this gospel for the precious message that it is, because eternity's already in the bag.
Amen. Well, Dr. Bennett, thank you so much for coming on today. We really appreciate having you on. We like to give our guests the last 60 seconds of the time on to kind of cover anything that we might not have discussed or kind of wrap up the conversation with your own words. So the next 60 seconds are yours.
Honestly, I'd rather just end with pointing to our Egyptian friends and those brothers and sisters who have been willing to count the cost because they've seen how precious and valuable the gospel is. And I hope that we can take that example and also take on this disposition that recognizes what a precious thing the Lord has entrusted to us, and that it comes with a responsibility and a stewardship.
Amen. Well, thank you so much for coming on today. We really appreciate having you on.
Absolutely. Thank you, Jenny.
Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of the Cedar 60 podcast. We hope you'll join us next time as we continue to explore culture and politics from the distinctive lens of the gospel. Don't forget to like and subscribe to this podcast on all major platforms and on social media. And thank you so much for listening. We hope you'll join us next time.